then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you woke'll, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's February the 5th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Well, here we are for the third Radio Free Northwest podcast, and although it's still experimental and I haven't been able to figure out how to do a proper mix yet, I think I'm starting to improve a bit. I'll try to give you guys closer to a full hour here, at least until my voice pegs out hopelessly. I'll be honest with you, I don't know how Rush Limbaugh can do 3 hours, 5 days a week, but then he not only has all kinds of technical staff and assistants, but he's getting paid about $200,000 per show or something like that, so I'm sure that helps to motivate him. We're going to adopt a different format from now on for Radio Free Northwest, and that we'll be taking the reader questions and suggested topics first, and after our first musical break, then I'll go into my rant for the week, otherwise known as the monologue. Like I said, I'll try and give you a full hour this time, and I may even play DJ and take two musical breaks in the show to try and give my voice a rest. But even so, I want to apologize in advance if I cough or hack during this broadcast. There seems to be a kind of weird cosmic Murphy's Law shaping up that dictates that my voice is fine for a whole week, and then on the day that I'm going to be doing one of these podcasts, that's when my lung burn comes back and I start to wheeze and my voice goes all gravelly. But we'll see how it goes. Before we get to our listener questions, I want to expound a bit on something I said in the last podcast, and which caused a bit of a panic reaction among some of our listeners. I got some emails that seemed almost frantic as the people sending them told me, "For God's sake, Harold, you mustn't even mention Barack Hussein Obama and the word assassination in the same broadcast, never mind in the same sentence. Don't you know the security organs are stalking you and looking for an excuse to lock you up?" And that was the gist of the responses. Anyway, I want to say, first off, that I genuinely appreciate the concern that some of you showed for me, but folks, it's like this. Yes, I know the organs, as Solzhenitsyn called them, are hunting me. I mean, they'd hardly be doing their job if they weren't, now would they? You've heard the expression about defending the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Well, I'm one of the domestic enemies they refer to. There's never been any mystery about me, about who I am, about what I believe, or about what I think. I am a totally committed enemy of this evil government and this deranged society, which has not just made my own life so personally hellish, but which has destroyed whole generations of white people, a state that has mutated into a monster that's trying to exterminate all of the hundreds of millions of people on Earth who share my genes and my racial and cultural heritage. At least when the organs are spying on me, they've got the right guy. And they're not just conspiring to frame poor old Apu down at the Quickie Mart for possessing a couple of plastic jugs of household cleaner and bleach, claiming it's bomb-making material, and trying to claim that Apu is conspiring with Rashid the taxi driver to blow up Six Flags. Now, the organs hunt for Harold is kind of complicated by the fact that I don't actually do anything except what the Constitution supposedly guarantees me the right to do, but hey, that's never stopped them before. Ask Matt Hale and Bill White how that worked out for them. One of these days, probably during Obongo's second term, when he lets all that monkoid hatred of white people hang out, the Democrats will find some way to dispense with the Constitution altogether. Bush and the neocons already left in the Patriot Act and the Military Commissions Act of 2006, and those come mighty damn close. And once the organs find out how to deep-six the Constitution, they can just come and take me away like I'm sure they long to do. But until that day comes, I have made the decision that I intend to exercise the tattered remains of my constitutional rights to the fullest. I will under no circumstances allow the federal government of the United States to dictate to me what I can think and what I can say out loud or what I can write, because I'm afraid of that government's retaliation. That's terrorism. And I will not knuckle unto. I just won't. I just will not bow down to these bastards. Yes, I know they're out there in their silk suits and their Gucci shoes and their black SUVs and their dark sedans with the illegally tinted windows. Some of our people have seen them recently. They're cruising the Northwest right now trying to develop informants, looking for anyone who will talk to them. That's all the FBI and the Secret Service and the BATFE and the DHS and the whole range of alphabet soup secret police agencies want right now, to come up with a list of anyone who will talk to them about anything, the weather, sports, politics, anything. They're looking for someone who will talk and not simply close the door in their faces when they don't have a warrant. They're especially looking for people who think they're clever and who think that they can match wits with them, which you are not, repeat, not clever enough to do. No one is, so don't try it. These people do this for a living, you know. They're carefully trained by some of the top psychologists and intelligence analysts in the world in this whole process of developing informants and extracting every last fragment of knowledge and data from what someone says, whatever someone is fool enough to talk to them. Now, that's the first step to developing information and also to developing an informant. To find someone who will talk to them about anything. Remember, you still have the right to remain silent, so exercise it, at least until they start waterboarding you. And also remember, they may have the power now, but in the long run, they're going to lose. Now to your questions and topics. Kate Barker asks, have you seen the news stories about all the white Northwest families adopting Haitians? What's the matter with these people? Well, Kate, I could tell you that these people are sick, self-hating whites who aren't worth a bucket of warm spit, which is true as far as it goes, but I suspect you know that, and that is, in fact, a bit of an oversimplification. Bear in mind that we are now living in a society where people of our race have been subjected to almost three generations of unremitting propaganda, brainwashing, and social engineering in order to make white people hate themselves, hate their race, hate their culture, hate the whole Western civilization that Europeans have created over the past 3,000 years. The Jews hate us for an understandable reason. They know that if white people are allowed to continue to exist, eventually no amount of brainwashing and social engineering will be able to prevent us from awakening to the truth about them, about what they are, and about what they've done to us and what they're still doing. That is, in fact, already starting to happen. The Jews are finding it a lot harder to pretend that they're just a harmless bunch of cute little fiddlers on the roof. Now, in 1967, a Jewess named Susan Sontag spelled all of this out. In a left-wing magazine called Partisan Review, she wrote, and I quote, "The white race is the cancer of history. It is the white race, and it alone, its ideologies and inventions, which eradicates autonomous civilizations wherever it spreads, which has upset the ecological balance of the planet, which now threatens the very existence of life itself," end quote. Now, what you have to understand is that these liberals who rule us now actually believe this. I'm not talking about just the Jews. I mean the white liberals. They believe that the white race is wicked and evil, and that for the good of Mother Earth and all the lovely little black and brown and yellow peoples of the world, we must cease to exist. We must commit a mass act of racial seppuku. Yes, I know all of the obvious objections to this idiotic notion, like if the white man isn't around, who the hell's going to keep the technology running, and who the hell will prevent the black and brown and yellow people from turning on the Jews and the liberals and wiping them out. I didn't say it was logical or that it made any sense. I just said that they believe it. Now, this is one reason why you get people like my two idiot brothers in North Carolina refusing to have children. It's ironic that in our family, only wicked racist me has bothered to reproduce, having wrapped up a total of 5 and possibly 6 children. Well, me and my one sister that my father spent his life ignoring and disowning, her too, but anyway, my brothers decided to be good little liberals and do their bit for the extinction of the white race by refusing to have children. And many liberals have made the same decision, either by not having children or by having only one child, which of course has its own problems. We have a whole new generation of left-wing liberal-only children coming up now who never had any brothers and sisters and who are more often than not spoiled rotten, in part because of that fact. This is also how you get this interracial adoption fad with people like Madonna and Brangelina more or less stealing little third world babies from Africa and Rochistan or wherever, and now from Haiti, where some bird-brained Christian missionary types were recently arrested for trying to abduct children from the country. Now they're getting a taste of Haitian prison, and maybe that'll wake up their ideas a bit. Apparently, only actual third-world babies have the proper liberal chic. If these rich glitterati jackasses really wanted a niglet to adopt, the orphanages in this country are full of them. I think there's a subtle little psychological tell there. Deep down inside, these big libs and Hollywood glitterati don't like American niggers any more than anyone else. Hell, nobody likes American niggers. Actual Africans who come to this country despise them as lazy criminal drug addicts and degenerates. I know because I've talked to African students and immigrants who've told me so. Now don't worry, Kate. These people will eventually get their comeuppance. You see, the difference between white people and blacks has nothing to do with environment or education or racism or upbringing. Blacks are biologically and genetically inferior to whites. Negritude is something they're born with and which they can't get rid of. Like the old saying goes, you can take the nigger out of the jungle, but you can't take the jungle out of him. And somewhere down the line, these liberal couples who are committing this madness will get their comeuppance in the form of drugs, violence, general shiftless uselessness, and maybe murder in their beds in the middle of the night when Junior comes home stoned out of his mind on crank and gets hold of a butcher knife. They'll get theirs all right. The laws of nature aren't like the laws of man. Those laws you can't break without impunity. Now, Jerry Click in Vancouver, I believe, asks, Dear Harold, how about something on the advantages of coming home? Light snow, 68-degree summers, oh, and 98% white. Oh, yeah. When I came home myself in 2002, after about 2 weeks, I sent out a letter to the mailing list in which I asked, why on earth would anyone not want to come here? When I wrote that letter, I was looking out my window at this brilliant landscape of green trees and grass, blue sky, brilliant sunshine, the perfect summer. And it was only about 62 degrees out. None of this miserable oven-like heat that you get in places like Texas or a sauna bath like you get in Charleston. Heat so bad that many white people of my age have to stay indoors in the air conditioning for months at a time because any lengthy walking during the daytime runs the risk of sunstroke, heat exhaustion, and heart attack. Basically, the Northwest gets a very bad weather rap, I think. Of course, I came home to the Northwest in the month of May, and I have to admit that, like most countries in the Northern Hemisphere, the homeland really makes the best first impression in the spring or the summer or the early fall, which is when I recommend that people make their scouting trips. I have to admit, February here can be a bit dreary, but then so can February everywhere. They say that every Northwest winter is the same, but every Northwest summer is different, and some of the summers I've seen here are nothing short of glorious. It's true that out along the Northwest coast there's a lot of rain. The beaches here are very spectacular, but in a rocky and scenic New England kind of way. They're not sunny beaches like Florida with big, wide, sandy stretches and warm water. In the summer, we do get tourists going to places like Seaside, Newport, and the Washington coast, but very few of them spend much time in the water, and you often need a jacket or windbreaker on the beach, even in July. We have surfers up here in the Northwest, and we even had one attacked by a shark off Newport a few years ago, but they have to wear thermal wetsuits, no Gulf Stream here. We've got something called the Humboldt Current, which is cold water and not warm. White men have become way too soft and spoiled as far as temperature goes. From living in places like California and Arizona and Texas, and as much as I hate to admit it, the South, everything always has to be warm enough to grow a palm tree in your bedroom. I sometimes hear from people who moan and groan, Oh no, Harold, I can't come home, it's too cold in the Northwest. Brrr. These are the same people who spend the months from mid-April to mid-October with their faces shoved into an air conditioner like a dog riding in a car with its nose stuck out the window. and their ears flapping in the breeze. They run from air-conditioned home to air-conditioned car to air-conditioned workplace and back again every day. Basically, when you come to the homeland, you're coming home weather-wise as well, to the kind of Northern European and Scandinavian climate that made our ancestors the people that they were. The coastal areas of the Northwest are kind of like Britain or Ireland, and the interior is either high desert with extremes of heat and cold, or else it's a forested Northern Hemisphere environment, very similar to Germany or Middle Europe, Bohemia or thereabouts, with four distinct seasons, warm summers, distinct springs and falls, and cold, snowy winters. If you don't like white Christmases and winter sports, the interior is not for you. Don't worry, after living a few seasons here, your body will start to remember, genetically speaking, and you won't miss the lack of air conditioning at all. Now, as far as economically speaking, yes, Virginia, there are jobs here in the Northwest, even in the middle of the Obama Depression. And yes, the percentage of white people is far higher in the urban areas than anywhere else around the country. And parts of the Northwest countryside are still 100% white. About the last place on the North American continent, you can still find that situation. But there is a catch. You have to hustle. You have to look for jobs. You have to dress up nice and go to job interviews and send out resumes and do all the same stuff that you would be doing elsewhere. You're not walking into some great white paradise ready-made. There are no white paradises left. I know because in my own youth, I went looking for the great white paradise in South Africa and Rhodesia, and it wasn't there either. If we want the great white paradise, we have to make it. And that is not going to be accomplished without blood, sweat, and tears. You have to come here with some assets in your pocket, enough to tide you over for a while, and above all, you have to come here with some skills and something to offer potential employers. In the last podcast, I mentioned the YMWNBTTSOTBs, the young men with nothing but the t-shirts on their backs. They are a separate problem, and probably I shouldn't even be discussing them in a public forum. They'll have their time and place, but right now, when you come home, you pretty much have to do it on your own steam. The party can give you help in the form of assistance, but we cannot give you money, we cannot give you a job, and we cannot guarantee that there will be no risk and no bumpy spots along the road home. You will have to check your American sense of entitlement at the Idaho or Oregon state line. Do not embark on this homecoming project expecting to be given things when you get here. You must be the ones who go first and weave the safety net for the others who will come after you, many of whom will be honest-to-God white refugees who stayed too long in Ohio and Florida and California and Chicago and who have to flee to the Northwest with nothing but the clothes on their backs and the American troops or the nigger mobs on their heels. I've just told you what your racial duty is. Now do it. Kind of got off the subject of the original question there, didn't I? Well, I suppose that's one of the risks of this kind of show. I guess it's time for our first musical break. Now, I think people may be getting a little tired of all the Irish stuff, so here's a little Norwegian black metal for you. This is Wardruna.
Yggdrasil has. I ditt liv ska spira växa. I ditt mörkre ska spira dig.
Okay, since my answering questions tends to degenerate into a monologue-style rant in any case, let's go for another question. Chris in Detroit wants me to talk about Obama's declining public favor. How close are we to civil war? Although that might be a dangerous one, tread lightly, I guess. End quote. Well, Chris, I think in my case, since I've authored 4 novels on that very subject, there isn't much point in treading lightly. Look, when they want to get rid of me, they're going to get me. Eventually, the organs will get tired of just spying on me, monitoring my internet activity from their cubicles, following me around, planting informers, breaking into my apartment to plant bugs and whatever else it is they're doing, and they'll simply make something up. Like I said in the last podcast, they'll just have to wait until Queen Nancy and Dingy Harry sneak Obamacare through by using some parliamentary procedural trick, which I still think they're going to do. Then I'm not only going to be unable to buy government-mandated health insurance, but I'll be in violation of the law. I'll be committing a federal offense by being poor, and they can come and take me away. And then again, Cicero said that the existence of many laws is the sign of a corrupt society. And by that standard, American society is corrupt as hell. There are so many little laws and statutes and regulations that if you try to comply with them, and you try to comply with them all, you end up tripping over your own shoelaces. The cops or the feds can arrest anybody they want. All they have to do is follow them around and spy on them long enough, and eventually they'll catch you breaking some minor little law that you didn't even know exists. Just have a little patience, guys, in the feds, you know, the FBI, whoever's listening. You'll get me eventually. Now, do you see what I mean about a simple question turning into a rave on my part? I'll have to work on that. Okay, back to the subject. Obama's declining favor, as you put it. Numero uno, most of Monkey Meat's so-called popularity never actually existed outside the media's imagination. This nigger was brought out of nowhere by certain very powerful elements in the liberal establishment. Exactly who isn't clear to me yet, but obviously there are people connected to George Soros. That's where his $500 million materialized from off the internet. Obama was groomed for the presidency from the very beginning, in my opinion, in order to prevent Hillary Clinton from becoming president. Now, this was done by a faction within the liberal power structure who hate Hillary's guts and who will do anything to thwart her. Obama started the race with all of the aces in his pocket, if you'll excuse the mixed metaphor, and almost all of the media, except for the hardcore feminist bitches, immediately deserted Hillary for him. He was hyped like hell from the very beginning. I can remember because back in 2007 I still had cable TV, and I watched cable news and The Daily Show, and I was stunned by the treatment that this high yellow bubble lip was accorded by the media. I mean, my God, you would have thought that Jesus Christ had returned to the earth. I have never seen anything like it. It was obvious to me even then that the one is, in fact, just plain dumb. The old saying about mulattoes being light and bright doesn't seem to apply in his case. I honestly think that blue gum ho Michelle is more intelligent than Barry is. Even then, he couldn't say anything even remotely intelligent without his teleprompter. It was always apparent that Barry was there because somebody put him there. Then he gets into the Oval Office and he's surrounded by Jews like Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod and Cass Sunstein. So now we know who. As to his loss of favor, as you say, for one thing, I think a lot of white people have finally woken up and said to themselves, "My God, we've got a nigger in the White House." But there's more to it than that. We need to understand that increasingly, as the years go by, yes, there are some serious differences between the two establishment parties, not so much of basic ideology, since they all basically accept political correctness and racial diversity and all that crap, but in matters of the cut between thieves, the divvying up of the spoils, the squabbling and feuding over who gets what slice of the pie has become increasingly bitter and almost violent at times, as witness the Republicans stirring up the whole Tea Party movement and then trying to take it over. Basically, the Republicans and the Democrats just can't seem to play nice anymore. And that was always the foundation of the two-party system, the fact that it was really one party of rich men and Jews who called all the shots. But the pie is shrinking now in the 21st century, and there is no longer enough to go around, especially when both sides have become as greedy as pigs. At one point, they had this arrangement whereby they shifted sides every 8 years. It seems to have begun in 1992 when George Bush Sr. was done out of the White House by Ross Perot's third-party effort. And in order to prevent third parties from horning in on the action, the two main parties appear to have agreed to 8 years per president with a changeover every third election, with the party who was scheduled to lose each election under this arrangement putting up a real unelectable doofus, i.e. Bob Dole, Al Gore, John Kerry, and John McCain. Although Jugear's Bush was such an obvious idiot that the GOP had to fiddle Florida and eventually get their man appointed by the Supreme Court in order to maintain the treaty or whatever this 8 year per president arrangement is called. That arrangement has worked for almost a whole generation now, and the Republicans dutifully threw the 2008 election by putting up Grandpa Simpson as their candidate against Barry this year. Plus, Obongo had Acorn and George Soros' money behind him, and so, you know, he waltzed right in. But then the Democrats seem to have realized that with the Electoral College giving more weight to big states with huge cities full of blacks and minorities, both in the presidential elections and also in the House of Representatives, which are also apportioned according to population, under the terms of the arrangement, they seem to have decided to go for perpetual power. They don't see any need for it anymore. Basically, all you've got to do nowadays in order to win the presidency is get about 8 states. You've got to have the 5 big ones, Texas, New York, California, Illinois, and it's just so. Then you've got to maybe have a couple more, like in the Rust Belt, like Pennsylvania, Ohio, so forth and so on. That's basically how Obama won. And the Democrats have come to realize that they don't really need to share power with the Republicans anymore, especially if they can get those 30 million illegal aliens in the country amnestied and get them voting Democrats. If they pass that amnesty bill, that's it. The Democratic Party is in power for the foreseeable future for the rest of the century. Now, with the power that they've got in 2008, the Democrats have been trying to transform America into a quasi-Marxist socialist state, nationalizing major industries like the banks and Wall Street brokerage firms and auto companies, so forth and so on, and they started actually seriously threatening the major private sector fortunes and corporate capital on which the Republican Party's power base is founded. Rush Limbaugh has at least that much right. And then this whole Obamacare thing came up when they attempted to create a so-called health care system that basically boils down to an immense power grab to give the government an excuse to control and intrude into people's lives in the name of public health, and which, by forcing the last remaining productive private sector white people to buy means-tested health insurance at murderous expense while lowering the premiums almost to non-existence for the so-called disadvantaged, it's simply a blatant attempt to transfer white wealth to people with black and brown skins in the form of free medical care. White people, believe it or not, are not totally stupid. Yes, I know, sometimes that really is hard to believe, but it's true, especially where matters of money and taxation and things that personally affect them are concerned. Slowly but surely, be it via tea parties or Rush Limbaugh or whatever, white people are finally beginning to get through their skulls full of red, white, and blue mush that they are personally in danger from Obongo and from the government. Right now, they're looking for the old solutions, the ones that they have been taught all their lives are supposed to work. They're reactionary in their outlook, meaning just that, they're reacting. But when they discover that reaction gets no results, they will become more revolutionary. Okay, I think it's time for that second musical break. For those of you yahoos out there who are concerned about all this hair fern stuff Harold is playing, I think I'll lay a little Ralph Stanley clawhammer banjo on you. Can't get much more American than that. Now, Ralph is an acquired taste. Some of you may remember him from the soundtrack of the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where he sang the a cappella traditional song Oh Death. But he's also the father of the Virginia three-finger picking style, which is kind of like bluegrass for dummies. And needless to say, that's the style I used back in my own youthful banjo picking days. Plus, of course, he's a hell of a clawhammer player, as you can see.
I don't believe I'll go, I don't believe I'll go, just to keep down trouble, don't believe I'll go. I've got a mule to ride, I've got a mule to ride, ain't got no saddle but a raring to ride. Said to the drake,
what'd he say?
The duck said to the drake,
quack, quack.
If you get my body, you have to swim this lake. I've got a mule to ride, I've got a mule to ride, ain't got no saddle but I'm raring to ride.
Oh, saw a little cane, see my candy dog and sweet little Hunter Jane. Go to Rocky Island, ho, honey, ho, 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 ho. See my candy dog and you know Oliver's soul. I was 11 years old, my mother taught me to play this style, an old tune called Shout Little Louie. Since that time, I recorded it and played it all over the world. People seem to like it, and I hope you'll enjoy it here tonight, as I play it and sing it as much as I could, like my mother taught me. Thank you.
Okay, we're about up to 40 minutes now, and I promised you a full hour, and I'll do my best to deliver it. Now, the last part of the RFN podcast will usually be where I wax all spiritual and metaphysical, and also where I start to wing it. So expect a few more e's, uhs, and mumbling than there was in the first part of the cast. Almost every week, I get some email or a letter from someone, usually a newbie, asking me, Harold, what the hell is wrong with us? Why aren't we going anywhere at all in this so-called movement of ours? It's a movement with no motion. Why aren't we doing anything about this horror that we live in? Now, guys, I have spent almost my entire life studying that very question. In fact, I've been studying it since I went to Chapel Hill High School in the 1960s and 70s. And I have to admit, I have not yet come up with a single definitive answer that I can lay out for you in 25 words or less. At Chapel Hill High, I first saw liberalism in action. I witnessed the reluctance, not only of my fellow white students, but of the white school administration to do anything about the niggers. And when I spoke up about it, I was threatened, victimized, oppressed, and my formative years were virtually wrecked. Without going into a long anecdotal digression, the fact of the matter is that for 3 years I lived in a jungle where these savage beasts were allowed to simply run wild. There was not even a pretense made of trying to discipline them. They were destroying the educational environment for the white kids who really did want to try and learn something. It was clear that everyone knew this, even though they would only speak about the problem in private whispers while they were looking over their shoulders to see who was listening, and nobody seemed to give a damn. Bad nigger craziness was simply accepted at that school like it was the weather or a plague or some other natural disaster or divine visitation, and that there was nothing to be done about it. I started asking why we're like that back then, and like I said, after 40 years, I have to say that I still haven't been able to come up with a quick and a simple answer. Now, there are, however, a couple of sound bites I can throw out, like the fact that white males simply are no longer the men that our ancestors were, physically or morally. They've been corrupted, and their brains have been turned to tapioca, and their spines have been turned to linguine by television and computers and luxury. Now, there's the fact that we've been socially engineered to be useless wimps by generations of Jewish propaganda, where the typical white male is Homer Simpson or Peter Griffin. There is the fact that society has been feminized and white males have been taught not to be men, never to grow up. White boys are taught to hate themselves and their natural instincts. They're taught to obey women and defer to them as superior beings. And in turn, white women have been almost completely corrupted with liberalism and feminism. All of these things are true as far as they go, but none of them really cover the whole question. So let's just say I'm still learning. A large part of the problem is the complete elimination of almost any moral or spiritual element from American life. 700-club-style Protestant evangelical fundamentalism doesn't count. That's not really a religion. It's a political ideology. It's a smokescreen for Zionism and neoconservatism and the Republican Party. I've said this before. White nationalists seem to be very confused about what it is we really want. It would appear that when push comes to shove, what most of us really want is the middle-class American good life, which we were promised in our youth in exchange for conformity, and which America has so signally failed to deliver. Of course, some people like me never conformed, so I have no cause to complain, personally. Sure, if I'd conformed and been a good boy and inherited the family business like I was supposed to, I could probably be running Serta mattresses right now, living in Greensboro, driving a Lexus to work at the factory, married to one of my girl cousins to keep the preferred stock in the family. As an aside, if I'd gone to business school for an MBA, I've always wondered which one of my two cousins, my uncle and my grandfather, would have tried to set me up with as a wife. One was a couple of years older than me, and one was a couple of years younger. But I digress. In any case, I never wanted the American dream. With me, it was always the Iron Dream. I don't know why. like I said, I guess I'm just some kind of freak or throwback to an older time. But let's face it, I was something of a freak, a throwback, even for my own generation, when there were still some memories of the old ways left. And most people aren't like me, and I know that. What American white people want in life is what they've been taught to expect, which is things, material goods. They want houses and fancy cars and boats and fancy technological toys and all kinds of tasty junk food. They want an endless adolescence that continues on into their 40s like one interminable Porky's or American Pie or Animal House movie. Now that's what white people, especially white boys, are taught to expect by the television and the music industry and the movie screen and the internet. And when white America fails to live up to the expectations that they've been given, when Jewish America doesn't deliver those things, like spoiled children, white people moan and groan and whine and complain and go to tea parties and wave signs and demand that the grown-ups give them back their toys. The thought of actual revolution, of physically removing the power structure, of ceasing to beg the grown-ups for their toys back and instead knocking them to the floor and kicking them in the head and taking their wallets and their car keys, this thought doesn't occur to white people. Not yet, it doesn't. But it will, comrades, it will. It's just human nature. I see clear signs that it is finally starting to get through some of these people's skulls full of mush that the system is not their friend, and that the whole system is in fact the problem and not the solution, that they will not be allowed to vote their way out of this because they will never be allowed to have any real candidates under the two-party system. Always remember, history is not made by majorities who vote. History is made by minorities who fight. White Americans are still in the phase of looking for someone from within the system to come riding in on a white horse, flourishing his saber aloft, save us all and bring back the days of Ozzie and Harriet and the Brady Bunch. Hence this fascination during the last election with Ron Paul. The desire to vote our way out of this is ingrained in us because walking into that stupid booth and pulling the lever to decide which thief you want robbing you blind and lying in his teeth to you takes so much less effort than actually standing up like a man with your spine erect, confronting and resisting the people who are doing us such terrible harm, removing them forcibly from their positions of power, and at long last punishing them for what they have done. Oh, that's too hard. Harold, the hill is too steep. I just can't do that. Oh, no, I want to sit on my sofa and click my remote and, you know, watch South Park and blah, 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 blah. To do what has to be done in order to save yourself and your children takes immense courage, and I don't mean just physical courage to face prison and bullets and death and pain. I mean moral courage to accept the world as it is and to accept that this duty and this burden at this point in history has fallen to you, not someone else, you. And you yourself personally are morally obligated and required by God and basic human decency to put yourself in harm's way and to put all you have at risk in order to bring an end to this horror. Very few white Americans have that kind of character and integrity left. It's been systematically bred and conditioned out of us for generations by the Jews, specifically to make sure that we would never rise up in our racial defense. Will we get it back in time to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children? I don't know. You tell me. Well, my time's up. My voice, I'm sorry, is about shot. Don't think I quite made it to an hour, but I gave it the old college try. Anyway, that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4586, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andenban. Freedom.
there beside the singing river, the dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune.